From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, ETs and spirituality, but we've got lots going on right now. The last communication received from a Malaysia Airlines plane suggests everything was normal on board minutes before it went missing over the South China Sea. Flight 370 replied, "All right, roger that," to a radio message from Malaysian Air Control. The search has been widened now to waters off both sides of the peninsula. And moments ago, a Chinese satellite probing the mysterious disappearance of the Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 claimed that observed a suspected crash area at the sea. The Chinese government said that a pivotal lead into what thus far has been a frustrating, fruitless search. However, Malaysians are saying that they have looked at that spot. Vietnam has looked at that spot, and they see no plane debris. So the plot thickens and continues to be a mystery. In a moment, David Tsuchi joins us as we will talk about his work, Why Planes Crash. But we don't know if this one did crash, but he'll join us for a bit in just a few moments. Sunspot AR-2002. Has been mostly quiet for the past 24 hours. Nevertheless, the Earth-facing active region has a magnetic field that harbors so much energy it could give off a very big M-class or a 15% chance of an X-class flare. And that's not good for our power grid. And I'll tell you what else is not good for the power grid. Electric grids across the country have faced an uptick now in unauthorized intrusions by unknown individuals, causing concern that the U.S. grid is vulnerable to widespread sabotage. Let's check in with the author of One Second After about EMP attacks, William Forstchen, about this incredible story. William, we have been watching this unfold over the last several months now. How vulnerable is the grid, first and foremost, to a physical attack?
George, it's a pleasure to be with you, and highly, highly vulnerable. I just attended a meeting on this a couple of months back. Let's take a look, for example, at what's occurring in Ukraine right now. Even before the uprising in Ukraine started in their downtown area, Kiev, back in November, the Russians had already infiltrated malware into their computer systems. We're going to see a potential meltdown of Ukrainian power grid system, as they did to Georgia and also tested on the Baltic states several years ago. A future that America could very well be facing.
No question about that.
NMA attack, or even just hackers who decide they want to have some fun some evening and shut the city down.
Now, the hackers, of course, you know, we've seen what they've done getting into people's personal information just by playing around on the Internet. How easy is it for them to hack a grid?
I was at a conference at this at the Army War College at Carlisle several years back, and I wish I had time to share all the stuff that left us gate mapped at the end of 2 days, at how vulnerable we are in terms of infrastructure control, command and control, even military access. Thank heavens, at least some of our military is reacting to this, but we are a highly vulnerable system. We are living in a glass house, and there's enemies outside with rocks, and they know how to throw them.
All right, we got to get you back to talk more about this then. It's an amazing story that affects every American, the grid. Could rush hour be putting you at greater risk for heart disease? New research from the University of Washington in Seattle finds that high amounts of pollution from cars is associated with changes in the heart's right ventricle. This could increase a person's risk of heart disease. The danger comes from the exposure to nitrogen dioxide from car fumes. Who better to ask than Christian Weil from MyHeartBook.com, noted author and researcher. Christian, so you sit in your car, you're in the middle of rush hour, you're trapped in traffic, and it's hurting your heart.
You just took the words right out of my mouth. We all know what that's like, particularly on a bad air day or behind a bus, a city bus.
Oh, my God.
They accelerate, and you can hardly see yourself through the windshield. And that's a bit of reality. But these monoxides, these nitrogen dioxides, George, you just mentioned, are what harms not only the heart, but the lungs of people with COPD and asthma, and they've even been linked now to childhood cancers. There have been studies which showed people living close proximity to a freeway, or particularly an on-ramp to the freeway where cars accelerate, have even greater risk than those living a distance from the heavy traffic. Pregnant women have to be very much aware of this also.
Now, you have researched a lot on turmeric and how it helps people with all kinds of afflictions. Does it help the heart as well? That's one thing we haven't talked about.
It does help the heart. The studies were done in Toronto. And I'm going to back up for a second, George. We always think of heart failure as left ventricle hypertrophy. But right ventricle, which this study just relates to,
that's right,
is just as deadly. So when the heart becomes massive, when it enlarges, your chances of a heart attack and heart failure are much greater. So to answer your question, yes, turmeric at the University of Toronto, in the studies they did, shrunk the enlarged heart. So anybody who is dealing with an enlargement of the heart, which is basically heart failure, they might talk to their doctor about taking turmeric to reduce that enlargement.
You can track Christian's work, myheartbook.com. In a moment, David Tsuchi joins us. His book, Why Planes Crash and Accident Investigators Fight for Safe Skies. We're going to talk about this Malaysian Airline 370. It is a bizarre story, but I do want to get David's take on this. We've got him for just a short amount of time, so we'll be right with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. David Tsuchi, born in 1959 in Boulder, Colorado. He grew up in Arvada, Colorado, and has traveled the world extensively, improving safety awareness. He worked in the cockpit on the hangar floor, within the aviation boardroom, and inside Washington, D.C.'s Beltway. He's seen death up close and personal as well. David, thanks for joining us at this late notice. And, of course, your book, Why Planes Crash, is being read right now, and I think record numbers. And what's your take, David, on this Malaysian Airlines flight? I mean, everybody's come up with their own theories, but what do you think's going on here?
Well, first, thanks for having me on here tonight. And it seems to me that the more we talk about this and the more I find out about it, the less I know. I'll tell you, I've never felt so helpless in my life.
It's weird. It really is strange.
It sure is. It sure is. And you know, I was just looking at this thing about the that they found some debris out there in the, with the satellite, and I was looking, trying to find it on our own satellite systems ourselves, but there's just nothing there now that was there before.
And they just came out and said, well, it looks like there's nothing to it.
Yeah, yeah, which concerns me a little bit, you know, for a number of reasons, but because it looks like there legitimately was something there that morning after, and then now it's not, so I'm curious. It's pretty shallow water, though. They still should be able to pick it up. So, I don't know. It's got to be so difficult on those families and people waiting to hear. But when we keep coming up with these theories, and then it looks good and it looks bad, I can only imagine what they're going through.
Let me ask you this: Would pilots that are in a locked cockpit open the cockpit door if somebody with some kind of knife or other object might be holding passengers at bay, threatening to kill them?
No, I don't think that would ever happen. I mean, that's the purpose of having that door lockable and defensible the way that it is. And pilots are trained in that, specifically psychologically trained to handle that type of a situation. So I really don't see that happening. The only possibility of breaching the cockpit at this point is when one of the pilots, you know, has to leave the cockpit to go use the restroom or decides to take a stretch and get something to eat. During that time, the cockpit door is locked behind them. The flight attendants will put a cart or something in between the front seats and the cockpit door while that occurs. So it's very safe and secure exchange of people moving in and out. There has been the one occasion when that happened and the pilot left the cockpit, the door was locked behind him, and then the other pilot had a mental breakdown inside and was took control of the aircraft by himself. So you know, there's that possibility, but I don't carry a lot of stock in that possibility right now, though, because at the time that the aircraft went off of radar, it was during a transition time from the Vietnam airspace into another air country's airspace. So during that time, it requires two pilots, so I really seriously doubt that one of those pilots would decide to get up at that time and leave the cockpit and open that door and make it vulnerable.
Let's talk about also, David, some of the inconsistencies here associated with this. First of all, we're getting a little scratchy line from you. We might have to reconnect, but I'm not sure it's your fault. We've been having some AT&T issues of late. But the fact that the plane veered off course, I mean, by 100 miles at least, what does that tell you?
Well, it can mean a lot of different things. When something catastrophic happens on board the aircraft, you only have two pilots, and that cockpit gets extremely busy trying to just keep that airplane flying. So that demands all the attention. People have asked me, why wouldn't they have made a distress call? Why wouldn't they have said something? But when something dramatic happens, the first thing you do is maintain control of that aircraft. So if something happened to distract them, take their attention away, the last thing in their mind is you know, calling and saying, hey, we're having a distress situation here right now. The first thing they're going to do is stabilize the aircraft and then make those calls. So it appears to me that something happened to make them veer off course. It doesn't look like an intentional move. It didn't go directly 20 degrees and then 30 degrees and then 40. It went kind of into 20 for a while and then went into a 40-degree alteration in the course before losing contact with the transponders.
Let me ask you about the transponders now. Obviously, at this point, I'm speculating that somebody physically shut those transponders off.
You know, that's the way it looks to me. If you look at the alternative to that, which would be that there was some kind of massive electrical failure on board the aircraft that caused all the electricity, all the communications, everything to go out on that aircraft, highly unlikely. This aircraft has triple redundancy, meaning that it has three different electrical buses off of which any of the electrical systems can run off of either one of those three. Then it also has three generators, which are feeding those buses, and they can be altered as well. So one generator can run all three, two can run three. The configuration of this aircraft is extremely complex, and it's very, very reliable. Let's say all of that failed, there's still another generator that's a RAM air generator that can be deployed into the air, and it'll create enough electricity to run the engines, run the communications, and the navigation equipment. So I really don't see, in my mind, that there's even a remote possibility that all the electrical system failed on that aircraft at one time.
Is it unusual that they haven't picked up the beacon sound yet?
Yes, extremely unusual, and that's my biggest concern at this point. It's it wasn't uncommon for that to happen in the old emergency alert locator transmitters, which were broadcasting at 121 megahertz, 121.5. Their reliability was only about 53% when an aircraft would go down. They since then have upgraded to 243 megahertz, and now the current ones, which this aircraft had on it, is up broadcasting at 400 megahertz. So there's two of these on the aircraft. The front one is activated by impact or by being jarred.
Yeah, land or water, right?
Well, the front one is only land. It's only being jarred. But the second one, it is waterproof, so it should be transmitting
right
just from being jarred. The one in the rear not only activates from being jarred, but it also activates when salt water touches it. So that's the one that really concerns me. So if the aircraft was ditched and sunk, that ELT should be putting out a signal.
All right, let's make a couple more assumptions here, David, that a bomb went off in the cargo bay. Maybe it was put in a suitcase and it got through security. Would the plane, if something like that exploded, and we, of course, don't know if it did or how big it would have been, but would the plane have traveled 100 miles that way or would it have gone right down?
Well, if that happened, which I don't think happened, but
nor
if
do
it
I.
did happen, then we would have an in-flight breakup. And in my experience with in-flight breakups, that spreads debris over miles. It can be miles. So you're 35,000 feet, You can only imagine each one of those pieces of debris would become its own aerodynamic force, and they lay out in the path of flight. So you would have debris scattered across the ocean, and it would stand out like a sore thumb with all the search and rescue and satellites that we have going on.
But you wouldn't track a plane for 100 miles, right, at that point?
Well, no. If that happened, it would be pretty much directly below or within maybe 10 miles of where the impact actually occurred.
I'm beginning to think that this plane has landed somewhere, David. I don't know, but I just think there's something strange here.
You know, I'm a factual person. I've always done investigations only based on what I know and what facts I have. But I got to admit, I feel hopeful about that. I don't know what it is inside of me that's telling me, because it all points to something else. But just inside my head, I keep thinking, God, wouldn't that be just something? You know, it would answer a lot of questions that we have. It would answer a lot of questions.
Well, and here's another part of the puzzle. Terrorists love publicity. They love to brag about their deeds. Nothing's happened here.
No. And that's why, again, I don't see that as a potential. There was a FBI specialist, I forgot his name, the other day that I was interviewing with, and he said, you know, that he didn't seem too concerned about that. He thought that this is a typical behavior for terrorists. I said, well, how's that? And he said that, you know, after our response to bin Laden and to 911 and all those issues that happened, because we were so aggressive about going after them, that they wouldn't have, you know, that maybe now they're not as so proud of it and not saying it out loud as to who it is because of fear of being attacked. And I said, well, why would they do it in the first place then? You know, that theory didn't make sense to me. If they're trying to invoke terror, then they would obviously be trying to take credit for it. So I'm not sure I buy that argument. So I don't know. I just keep going back and forth, and I'm not this kind of person. You know, I've been doing accident investigations a long time, and I without sounding patting on my back, but I'm pretty darn good at it, and this has got me baffled completely.
I would say that in your career, this has got to be one of the strangest cases ever. And I'm wondering what's going on now in the rooms of the FAA as they try to piecemeal in their own minds what happened with the folks at Malaysia Airlines and everything else. I'm just wondering if they have some information they're not passing on to us, David. Is that possible?
Well, that's happened to me a couple of times on investigations. For example, Flight 800. When there's a credible security risk of some kind, you know, the FBI, and this is within the United States, but the FBI, NSA, there's a lot of organizations that can, you know, that can say, hey, this is not in the best interest for everybody to know what's going on yet. There's mixed emotions with me about that, but, you know, during an investigation, it's never wise to put out a lot of information that's conflicting, because you're making assumptions. You're trying to explore those assumptions, and all it does is create, especially for people who are waiting to hear the fate of their family member, the last thing you want to do is give them hope or take away hope when it's not necessary. So, you know, there's reasons to not share with the public what's going on, and not that it's intentional even most of the time. It's just that you're so darn busy. You know, when I've done accident investigations, you work 24/7s. Until it's done, pretty much. You're napping on, you know, rolled up pieces of insulation in the hangar because you just can't go any further.
Boeing 777. It's a pretty darn safe aircraft. I know a lot of people who work at Boeing. They love this jet. Could the tail have fallen off?
You know, there was only one of those there's actually two, I think, that have occurred, but those were both Airbus aircraft. This tail is not mounted in a phenolic block like some of the other aircraft manufacturers do to try to save weight. This tail is a completely sound structure. The only thing that gives me pause at all is that repair to the wing that had been accomplished before, a while back and had been repaired properly, supposedly. And, you know, to me, that might answer some questions. But then again, if that wing came apart, or let's say they had a structural crack that they didn't detect during the repair, and that wing came apart, we'd be looking at a massive in-flight breakup of that aircraft. You can't be flying along at those kinds of speeds, lose a hunk of the wing, and not go down in a dramatic fashion.
All right, David, I know you have a very busy day tomorrow, so thank you for being with us. We will stay in touch with you. David Tsuchi, his book, Why Planes Crash, as we continue to follow this bizarre story. It is the 25th anniversary of the founding of the World Wide Web, and we're going to talk with Lauren Weinstein about that next on Coast to Coast AM. Beyond Belief, that's our television show, and it's available to you for free for 10 days. And you can watch all kinds of other videos when you do that. Simply go to this website, beyondbelief.com, and I think you'll like it, beyondbelief.com. And we will be back in a moment as we celebrate a little anniversary here of the founding of the World Wide Web. On the 25th anniversary of the founding of the World Wide Web, the innovator of the system that has revolutionized our world like no other invention is seeking legislation now to protect the rights of users, our rights. On March 12th of 1989, Tim Berners-Lee first put his paper to concept for what would eventually become the World Wide Web. And now the British computer scientist is fighting to preserve the privacy rights of the system. Here's Lauren Weinstein, of course, expert on the Internet. Well, at least the founder of the World Wide Web is trying to save it for everybody, Lauren, huh?
Yeah, I mean, Tim has been pretty consistently in this league. He's a real great guy. You know, he didn't patent any of the work he did relating to the development of the concepts that became the web. You know, he could have patented it, and we would have had a whole different story. He was at CERN at the time that he did the original proposal. That's the European Nuclear Research Facility in Switzerland. And that's where the first browser came from. That's where the first server was written. Then the rest is history, as the saying goes.
All right, Lauren, as we look at technology and what's been going on over the last couple of years, what do you see during this anniversary period as the biggest issue facing all of us right now? Is it the NSA privacy issues? Is it the fact that technology keeps booming along? What do you think it is?
I think in general it's that we're always behind the curve when it comes to understanding what the implications of our technology are going to be on the rest of our lives, from a policy standpoint, from an economic standpoint, from a legal standpoint. The technology comes first. No, it's always been this way. I mean, if you look back through human history, the technology has always led the way. But the implications now of not catching up to the best of our ability are more and more awe-inspiring and not necessarily in a good way, because the power to control communications that's now coming into play in the hands of national governments in particular is such that censorship and I hesitate to say it, but really thought control is what it amounts to, is if you don't have freedom of communications, are real, real concerns now.
What do you see as the huge revolution in the latest in technology? I think it's the smartphone.
I think I'll go along with that. The smartphone and the network infrastructures that support it, because, of course, a smartphone without something for it to talk to can do some interesting things, but it's going to be limited. Now, the flip side of that, of course, is that our smartphones and those networks are concentration points where communications can be controlled. And we've seen, for example, in some countries where there have been popular uprisings, for example, one of the first things that governments will do is that they will shut down the SMS networks, the messaging networks. They'll cut off internet access so people can't organize on Twitter or in other ways. They'll cut off the phone calls. So it's a double-edged kind of thing. On one hand, it gives people immense power as long as it's running. But if the governments have the ability to shut it off, suddenly people are holding these nice little boxes, but they can't do too much.
Lauren, the smartphone, of course, has, I think, created social networking. It's made Facebook what it is today because, generally, I think most people, when they access Facebook, they're doing it through their smartphones and such. So it really has created offshoots of other businesses, hasn't it?
Yeah, in fact, it's really very recently that we've kind of passed through an inflection point where we're seeing for certain classes of use anyway, more access of these systems from mobile devices generally, not just smartphones, but tablets and other things too, but portable devices in general, than from traditional desktops. Now, you know, some people say, well, the PC is dead, you know, you're not going to see PCs anymore. That's not true, of course, because it's pretty hard to do creation of content, of significant content on a smartphone. You're not going to edit a video or write a very long paper on your smartphone, probably.
That's right.
So you're always going to have the desktops for that kind of work. But in terms of consuming the content, it's clear that mobile has been tremendously powerful. And as the mobile networks become faster and faster and more ubiquitous, there's no reason to think that that's going to change, except more, you know, more in that direction.
How have the apps contributed to the smartphone success and popularity?
They've clearly, you know, played a major role. There's actually an interesting sort of, I won't call it a war, but a dynamic that's playing out even now between the question of whether apps per se, you know, the individual little programs that you run on a smartphone that do one thing, are necessarily the best way to do things compared with mobile websites that are more oriented toward mobile use, things like HTML5-based websites and things like that. It's more than an academic question, because apps tend to focus you into one service and one provider, whereas mobile websites may provide a broader palette for people to choose. But it gets very technical very fast. I have no idea how that's going to turn out. A lot of it has to do with, you know, which way people can make the money that they need to keep these services running and all of that also.
Lauren, as you look at the next 5 years, I don't even want to go any further than that because it changes so fast. What's some of the next things in terms of technology? Because, I mean, how many more things can they come up with?
Well, you'll recall that I don't know how far back it was, but back many, many years ago, there was the claim of a patent examiner or the head of the patent office or something that there was no need to keep the office going because everything significant had already been invented. And so I think we can always, you know, depend on more inventions. Excuse me. You're certainly right to go beyond 5 years, because you try to go much further than that, and any predictions are
out the window.
Yeah, I mean, you just make a fool out of yourself when you try to go too far in the future on these. But we know for sure that these smartphones in particular, and these networks in particular, are going to become more and more powerful. They're going to become faster. The flip side is that we have more and more concerns about censorship, about availability, about mergers of you know, large dominant ISPs that could have a negative effect on people's ability to access the internet. Because remember, here in the U.S., in some ways, we're a third world country when it comes to the internet. You can go to Korea, you can go to all kinds of places around the world, and you will get much, much faster internet than here, at lower prices than what we pay. And it's because we have this almost a monopoly system where the dominant ISPs have carved up the country instead of there being the kind of competition that was originally envisioned.
And, you know, and speaking of flip, as you say, I used to have flip phone a couple of years ago before I switched to an Android smartphone.
Yeah.
And it was very, very small. It was handy, fit in your pocket. You just flip it open, make your call. It wasn't great for sending text messages, and you definitely couldn't have access to the internet. How small is too small where it gets to the point where, here's an example, the smartphone I have now, I think is as small as I need, because if it gets any smaller, I'm not going to be able to read it.
Yeah, and you know, there's the opposite side of that too, which is there's this pressure in some quarters to make the smartphones bigger and bigger, so it's hard to tell the difference between is it really a smartphone or is it a tablet that can talk to the cell network. And there's also the pressure to make them thinner and thinner and thinner. And there you have a trade-off on batteries, right? So you can have a very small, very thin, very light smartphone, but it can be a struggle to get through the day. And from my standpoint, if you can't, you know, at least get through one day and have a little bit of juice left at the end of the day, that's a real problem, because you're not always going to be near a socket to charge up again.
You know, we've got a lot of people that listen to our program on their smartphones. And one of my big concerns is that, as you mentioned, the battery life doesn't last that long. When are they going to be able to fix that, where the batteries last maybe 2 or 3 days before you have to charge it?
You know, it's always a trade-off. In most cases, the aspect of a smartphone that uses the most power overall is the display. It's lighting up the display, the backlight of the display.
And how long the display lasts, stays on,
and,
right?
And how bright it is, how you have it set. So if someone has it set so it stays on for 2 or 3 minutes each time it's used instead of going off after 30 seconds, it can make a tremendous difference. But that kind of begs the question. I mean, we clearly need better batteries that can last longer. And you know, different kinds of displays. There's a lot of research being done in this area, displays that use less power, that can work in natural light better instead of always needing a backlight, all kinds of new battery technologies. But it takes time for these things to reach market. And, of course, there's this battle over prices all the time. So we're kind of in this in-between state now where we have some phones that could do remarkable things, but, you know, you get halfway through the day and it goes dead on you.
Okay, let's talk about Facebook for a moment, one of our favorite subjects, Lauren. I mean, how long does it last until the next fad tries to beat it?
Oh, I think there's all kinds of things going on now that are pushing the social networking space in different ways. Facebook has obviously itself moved on beyond what I think most people have thought of it being. The dynamic of the demographics of their users has been changing. I think what happened was as soon as younger people saw their parents friending them on Facebook, that was the time to move on to something
right.
Greener pastures.
Well, and they went to Snapchat, and Facebook was smart enough to buy Snapchat, not for that $19 billion ticket price, which I think is ridiculous, but they bought what could have been a future competitor.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, if you can take a competitor and you can roll it into your own ecosystem, in a good way. I mean, that's a completely reasonable, rational business decision. It can, of course, open up questions of who controls the communications and such, obviously. But we have that in any case. Facebook really, I think, has been pushing, has really been orienting themselves more for growth outside the U.S. now. I think that they may have felt that for their core services, they've really reached their limit and probably dropped off a little bit. But, you know, there's a whole big world out there. You may have heard that Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook's CEO, of course, was out talking to various European and other foreign cell providers, trying to convince them that they should, in essence, provide free cell phone service to people in exchange for, you know, kind of complicated business relationships with Facebook. Mm-hmm. And there was also the talk about drones, you know, this, which I think is, you know, they're really kind of, this is mostly PR at this point, but, you
right,
know, drone delivered to Facebook services, and internet services and things like that.
Yeah, that's going to be strange. I still don't know, Lauren, how do they monetize Facebook? How are they going to monetize Snapchat? I mean, how can you justify paying $19 billion for Snapchat? How do they make money?
Well, I mean, most of these services are ad-based, and that kind of explains it, because the way you need to look at, you know, $19 billion, you think of it, it seems like a completely insane amount of money.
I mean, you could buy General Motors for that.
Yeah, you think about traditional industries and what they're sold for, and maybe it's half or a quarter or even less. I think that the way that the market tends to look at this, and by the way, I'm one of those people that think Facebook, you know, probably overpaid in this case. And there's a lot of people who think they did. But there's another way to look at it, and that is they're buying a certain number of users at a dollar, you know, so many dollars per user. And if you look at it that way, you're not looking at extraordinary amounts of money per user that you've brought into your network, into your system. And I think that's normally, you know, that's the simple way to look at it. You're not necessarily buying the technology alone. You're buying the technology and all those people who are already devoted to that technology.
Well, no, that's a good point. They are paying for, I think Snapchat, for example, has 450 million potential users. Divide that into 19 billion. That'll tell you what they came up with per user. Somebody came up with that valuation, I guess.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, you're dealing when you look at the breakdowns of these products that are these services that are bought that way. They may have most of their users in parts of the world and in countries where you don't already have a really significant, or you may have a limited footprint or a footprint that's reaching the end of its growth. But if all of a sudden you can buy something and now you've bought a whole bunch of users in South America or Europe or some other part of the world, you can look at it that way and say maybe it is a reasonable transaction.
At what point do advertisers on those social networks say, I'm not getting a bang for my dollar here?
Well, I think that's a dynamic that's always in play. I mean, this is the methodology, you know, how much, you know, what the cost is per click and under what conditions is an ad displayed and under what conditions does an advertiser pay and how does an ad get displayed? This is a science now, an art. And it's constantly changing. It's not the same as it was 5 years ago or even 2 years ago when you actually look at the numbers. When you think about it, I mean, commercial television, for example, has been advertiser-based for a very, very long time. And obviously it's challenged in some ways now. Yeah. You know, there have been changes made along the way. And there's no reason to think that there's going to be a meltdown of advertiser-sponsored services. But again, on the other hand, there are people who, you know, don't like ads necessarily. There are people that run ad blockers and things. There's people who say, look, we'd be happy to pay for this service on a monetary basis per month instead of seeing ads. So you have to deal with a broad spectrum of people mm-hmm. that have different sensibilities about these things.
Well, I wonder what would have happened, for example, to Facebook had they started charging people as opposed to the ads.
Yeah, well, you know, if you tried to do something like that at the beginning, it probably wouldn't have.
It wouldn't have worked.
But the thing is, the whole way that the internet has developed and the web has developed has been not necessarily the way that one would have thought at the time if you went all the way back to the beginning. Because we were used to, you know, we're used to paying per month for phone service and paying per month for electricity and water and other things like that. The concept that we would get many of the services that we get now for free, essentially. I mean, you know, we're not paying out of our wallets anyway. For email and for communications and all of this. Really was not something that was necessarily predictable. But once the pattern was set for it, once people began to expect it to be delivered that way, that's something that's very difficult to change. It's one thing to have it one way at the beginning, but once people are used to it being for free to come in later on and demand payment, that's going to be a tougher sell.
So as I look at this 25th anniversary story of the World Wide Web and the founder Tim Berners-Lee, I don't see anything about Al Gore in these stories.
Yeah, you know, Al Gore actually got something of a bum rap on all of this because the story was, you know, that Al Gore had claimed that he invented the Internet. That's the popular meme. But actually, he never said that. Well, what he actually said was that he was proud of his involvement in the development of the Internet. And he actually did play a very significant role. If you talk to many of the founders of the Internet, they will say that Al Gore played a pivotal role in getting the Internet from being purely academic into becoming a commercial network that everybody could use.
Lauren, we're going to take phone calls with you in the final hour. You're going to stay with us in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.